소방 뜻이 있어.
Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is inner significance of rituals and ceremonies. Just today in the newspaper, probably you all must have noticed that mention is made of a very absurd ritual which is carried out in a small place in Karnataka where there is a temple of Yellamma, and a small girl of 8 or 9 years of age, she got skin disease, and the devotees of Yellamma say that, well, this is the wrath of goddess Yellamma, so this girl has to walk naked in the night after 12 o'clock from certain point, certain kilometers up to the temple, and the girl of 9 adamantly refused to do that, but the mother, having that blind belief, she said, I would do that on her behalf, and she did it. Of course, we are told that a documentary has been made, of course, by a person. This was something which was banned in 1980s, 1990s, but it continues to, go on. So a documentary is made on this kind of absurd rituals which are suggested by the devotees of this Yellamma. Now, therefore we see how today, in the scientific age especially, the words ceremonies and rituals have come to have a kind of derogatory connotation. You say something is done ritually, ritualistically, if you mean therefore that you are doing it mechanically without understanding its meaning. Actually, that is not really how a ritual or ceremony ought to be. And yet we find that how many Hindus really are aware of the rituals and ceremonies. In fact, it is said that from the cradle to the grave, all the obligatory duties of life of a Hindu are supposed to be delineated according to the Vedic rituals. In fact, these are called as samskaras. Samskara has got many meanings, but one of the meanings of samskara is that it is refinement. Something which is pointing out to you that this is a definite stage in your life, and now your existence is going to be more refined. From the mere physical existence, you are heading towards a more refined existence. So, at least 16 samskaras are there, but not all of them are valid or, as it were, relevant now. But some of them will read out to you, and you are well aware. Right from your birth, that is, your mother carrying you in her womb, the two first samskaras we are not mentioning, but the point at which she conceives is given a name, and there is a ceremony for that. Then, 7th month, we are aware, it is called, in Gujarati we say Kholo Bharwano, generally other name is Simanta. It is a Simanta ceremony, where after the 7th month of pregnancy, this is carried out. Name giving ceremony, Namkarana. Then, first when the child begins to eat solid food, it is called Anna Prashanna. The first hair cutting, Mundan ceremony. Then starting the school, Vidya Arambha ceremony. Thread giving, Upanayanam. Marriage, that is a Vivaha, marriage ceremony. And the funeral, it is Antyeshti, or the funeral ceremony. Of course, we have left out around at least other 4 or 5 ceremonies which are there. When a person enters the householder stage, he enters Vanaprastha ashram, when he enters Sannyasta ashram, again there is a ceremony. But all this is not relevant today. And all that we find today in a Hindu person's life is performance of some puja, which is performed ritualistically. The student has been a witness to this kind of a puja. Student's friend at the age of 11, great was the discipline as the student now recalls, but would go through that entire ritual of puja. 20 to 25 deities will be washed first with water, then with milk. The tilak would be put on all of them, a tulsi patra would be put, a mogra flower will be put, garlands will be put, aarti will be done, incense will be lighted. My God! But every day, because we wouldn't get to play with her, so we had to sit there and watch her do that. But we didn't find her to be any the better than what we were. And she also hardly understood what she was doing, but the parents told her, you better do that before you start your day. So this is how ritualistically the puja is done, and it is carried to the extreme of thinking that this is the end in itself. So much so that we were told once that a particular doctor would perform the puja, was performing his daily puja, and a patient was almost dying, but he would not attend because he could not leave the puja halfway. Something anishta will happen, so he will not get up in between in the puja and not attend to the patient. Now, this is what, in fact, is a very nice chapter in perennial philosophy called Spiritual Exercises. And this is what Aldous Huxley says, that your prayers, your moving the rosary beads, etc., or puja, if you start taking them as ends in themselves, but rather than means to an end, then they become an obstruction to spiritual life. And even through these pujas, at the most you are only contacting minor deities, not achieving the union with the divine. We won't read the first quotation. You can read that first quotation. That is what he says over there. So, we have to therefore remember that these rituals and ceremonies must not, first, remain mechanical, two, should not get undue importance in our life so that we forget our duties as human beings. Secondly, in the whole of the Indo-Iranian culture, you find that their idea was very different. They understood that there are these deities, there are these gods and goddesses. They are instrumental in creating the universe and in sustaining and maintaining the universe. Therefore, we must be making offerings, sacrifices, prayers, all these must be done and they must be propitiated. In fact, similar idea occurs in the Bhagavad Gita, third chapter, where it speaks about parasparam bhavayanta, mutually nourishing each other. The gods nourish you and you nourish the gods. So, Mr. Judge, of course, explains it, but it is said food comes from rain, rain comes from sacrifice, and sacrifice is performed by action. And Mr. Judge says that it is not as if food will not be produced if sacrifice is not performed according to the Vedic ritual. But right kind of food, which can actually be conducive to produce that health of the body, which will allow you to live up to your highest spiritual possibilities, will not be produced. And these days, he says, we have totally omitted these sacrifices. So the very gods whom we should be revering must have departed from our sphere to some other higher spheres. Moses, again, had instituted certain sacrifices and ceremonies, of course, mainly out of the reason for sanitation. Because remember, he was an initiate but dealing with the Jewish tribes. So he had to put it as if it was a religious observance so that they would follow it and it would bring about sort of hygiene and sanitation. And Mr. Judge mentions similar thing happening in India. He says there is, during cholera times, there is a ritual performed. It is called flower umbrella dance. And they burn a huge heap of camphor. And people dance around that fire which is made by burning camphor, singing and chanting shlokas, religious prayers, etc. They think it is a religious obligation to do it, but actually we know camphor is a disinfectant and it purifies the atmosphere. But it is enjoined as a religious observance. Now this happened in those days. The idea is, as Sri V.P. Vadia writes at one place, that the whole idea of these ceremonies and rituals, especially the karma kanda in the Vedas, the Vedas, one portion is fully karma kanda of the Vedas, is to drive home the point that your universe as you see it, functioning it beautifully, is not happening mechanically. There are deities, there are intelligences, there are powers behind it. Today we may say, because the water evaporates, it becomes vapor, clouds are formed, the cloud bursts, and the rain falls. Well, that happens every time. Then why do you have famines where there is no rain? Are there not any intelligences which are behind? There is a rain god. There is a god of the forest. There is a god of tree. There is god of fire. So there are these intelligences, and you have to therefore acknowledge the role played by these intelligences which are behind the functioning and maintaining of the universe. And so the reverence is due to them. Now these karmakandas and ceremonies, in a way, at a simple level, are acknowledging the role of these various deities, which otherwise we would not do. And that is why they are instituted. So we find that in the Indian tradition, however, there were ceremonies performed, of course, at a far higher level for obtaining something. So you have ceremonies and ceremonies of different kinds, sacrifices of different kind, Ramayana, Mahabharata, Puranas. You see, they talk about horse sacrifice, Ashwamedh Yagna, performed for getting power and glory. They have Rajasuya Yagna, performed when at the time of coronation of the king. Putra Kameshti Yagna, the yagna which was performed with the desire to obtaining a son and not a daughter, son only. So that again was a yagna or a sacrifice. And this way, hosts of sacrifices were performed. Now we find that the whole Vedic literature, interestingly, is not just restricted to these yagnas and ceremonies, which was passed on by word of mouth. We have often said this before, but that Vedic literature is divided into four parts. There are Samhitas. That is what form our proper Vedas. We have Rigveda Samhita, Samaveda Samhita, Atharvaveda Samhita, Yajurveda Samhita, of which Yajurveda and Atharvaveda are mainly concerned with having those verses or shlokas with a performance of rituals and ceremonies. But later, there is also Brahmanas which were added. So you have Aitareya Brahmana, Taittiriya Brahmana, and so on. The Brahmana portion of the Vedas is important because it explains to you the inner meaning, the significance, the sacredness of the ceremonies which are performed. And then there were Aranyakas, which are called the forest treatises. Here, interestingly, when the old people, they retire into forest and they are incapable of performing physically the sacrifice, then for them, there was, as it were, special kind of contemplative or meditative procedures which were there. For instance, one of the writers has said that instead of performing Ashwamedha Yagna, he would go in the forest, meditate upon the Ushas or the dawn as the body of the horse. He will meditate upon sun as the eye of the horse, as if he is performing a sacrifice. But this is in fact a step forward, because you are now told, leave behind the physical sacrifices and rituals, move over to the life of contemplation and meditation. And in fact, it is the Aranyakas which paved the way for Upanishads. Because as Shankaracharya says, Upanishads are for those who are not interested in the worldly or otherworldly prosperity. You want something here, or you want your merit so that you can spend a lot of time in heaven. So for either of the prosperity, people would perform sacrifices. But Upanishads are not for that. Upanishads are the rahasyas of the Vedas. They are the esoteric knowledge. They are the esoteric meaning of the Vedas, which are mainly concerned with, of course, properly living the life, and more on the side of acquiring knowledge, contemplation and meditation. Now, it is not as if the sacrifices and rituals are useless, or they will not have any meaning, or will not produce any results. In fact, we are told, if properly performed, they will not fail to produce the results. They will positively produce results, but properly performed. And this is one of the great problems, where even today we find people performing yagnas. Many times we see here in the newspaper, not enough rain has fallen, so-and-so portion of Bombay, they are going to perform a yagna for rain to come. Many earthquakes, people will again start performing yagna, earthquake must stop. Why does it not have efficacy? Because we are told that it must be performed in a prescribed manner, prescribed order, prescribed method, so precise. It's in fact a science by itself. Yagna Vidya we talk about. It's a science by itself, where the whole Yagna Kunda has to be of a certain shape and size, placed in a certain manner. The paraphernalia must be placed in certain manner, in certain directions. Most importantly, the shlokas which are chanted at that time. And we know how much emphasis HPP has put on Mantrika Shakti, that the shlokas which are chanted, they, and the efficacy of the shloka or the verses is in the sound. So if you mispronounce a single word, if you miss out the rhythm, you pronounce it fast or if you pronounce slow, it will have either no effect, then you are lucky, or it will have disastrous effect. As we are told, And this perhaps this instance is given absolutely to drive home this point that a person, he wanted to kill Indra. And so he recited a shloka and in which he was supposed to say, give me a son who will be killer of Indra. But a single mispronunciation, he ended up saying, give me a son whose killer will be Indra. And sure enough, he got a son who was killed by Indra. Now, this is just to show the correct pronunciation and the very precision which is required if you want your ceremony to have the desired effect. Now, there are ceremonies performed, of course, which would fall more on the black magic side for hurting and harming someone. And they would, again, produce results when it is properly performed. There are ceremonies, unfortunately, also performed by people who want to dodge the karmic consequences. They are called pariharas. We are not aware of any perfect ceremony, but we've heard about the word parihara. They say that you perform a ceremony, and often the example we give is that they will refer to the shastras, they will dig out some ceremony. If you have killed a cat, perform an elaborate ritual ceremony, and at the end, make a cat of gold. According to your capacity, maybe a 1 kilogram gold or maybe 1 ounce gold. But make a cat, give it to the temple, the Purohit, and your sin will be washed off. Now, it doesn't make sense. This is like, again, as absurd a ceremony as we, ritual as we were talking about of these people in the region of Karnataka. So what HPP says, that even if you were to have someone who could perform this ceremony, who has this knowledge, what will happen? You have only postponed the day of settlement. Your karmic consequences are going to come to you because you can't really dodge the karma. But you have postponed the day. It is going to be not only postponed, it's become more severe. See what she says in the third quotation. It has been explained numberless times that no adept of the right path will interfere with the just workings of karma. Not even the greatest of yogis can divert the progress of karma or arrest the natural results of actions for more than a short period. And even in that case, these results will only reassert themselves later with even tenfold force, for such is the occult law of karma. So, all these so-called ceremonies for averting the consequences are not really desirable, even though if they are efficacious and possible. And that is why, remember, that those who really earnestly want to live spiritual life, these things are of no use. In fact, they are supposed to avoid them, as one of the things said by in Raja Yoga or occultism. Where HPP gives qualifications for chelaship. One who wants to become a disciple, one who really wants to live spiritual life in earnest, let him not try and resort to any of these propitiatory ceremonies to try to deviate the course of the law of karma from its path. This is something which we have to accept and keep in mind. So for a person who really wants to walk the spiritual path, there is no alternative but first to accept what comes under karma, saying that my own has come back to me. Change the situation if you can by all mundane means rather than resorting to any otherworldly kind of methods. And thirdly, if such a thing is not possible, then give your best response to that particular situation in which you are put. Without grumbling, without complaining. Try to go through it. And if possible, even learn the necessary lesson if you can see what that situation is meant to teach you. But apart from that, there is no trying to dodge your karma through ceremonies and rituals. Now, going backwards from the antyeshti, that is the ceremonies for the dead, we can see that every religion, of course, has its own ceremony for the dead. You find the Hindus believe that after death, the person is supposed to remain in the earth's atmosphere for at least 10 days. Then they have ceremony of Shraddha or Shraddha and Pinda, offering the rice balls. Similarly, Russians have a ceremony where they will take a plate full of rice and stick a candle in the middle of the plate and put it on the grave for 6 weeks continuously after the death of a person, the Christians will have a mass which will go on day after day after the person has died. All these are mainly arising out of the understanding, partly out of the fear, that probably the person may have died with some desire, some wish which was so intense and yet remained unfulfilled. If that is so, then it is possible for this soul to remain earthbound entity. That in the astral body, this soul will remain in the earth's atmosphere, attracted to the earth, and as they say, it will become a wandering soul or a ghost. And that is why we must perform some ceremony through which somehow it is possible for a person on the earth to satisfy that unsatisfied desire, then the release of the soul can take place. So, as T. Subba Rao at one place writes about the ceremony of the Pinda, he says that probably this is how the belief is, that they will offer the rice balls. The crows are supposed to come and eat those rice balls. Suppose the crow doesn't touch the rice ball, then what they believe, that the crow is a sensitive creature. It is able to see the astral figure which comes and covers the rice ball. So the crow is not able to touch. So at the same time, if the crow doesn't touch the rice ball, immediately the relatives of the dead person begin to recount the wishes, probable wishes of the dead. That do you want your son to be got married? Do you want that the property should be equally divided? Do you want that whatever they think could possibly have been the intense wish, they recount. When the right thing is hit upon, the crow, it is said that the astral figure will release the rice ball and the crow will touch. And then, of course, as they recount the wish, they also promise to fulfill it. It is fulfilled then. Now, HPP says, well, she doesn't give much credence to this kind of a belief. But it is true that the soul is held in the attracted to the earth's atmosphere if there is unfulfilled desire. Of that there is no doubt. Now, whether someone on the earth can really satisfy it or not, all that is, and for that, whether this ceremony will be useful or not, we are not too certain. And what T. Subba Rao points out also, is that is why in the ancient times, but we don't have that facility now, there used to be always an initiate or an adept by the side of the dying person, so that somehow he can come to know about his clinging and attachment, and he can make that person let go of his attachment to the worldly things, so that we can say the soul departs in peace. And it's a kind of a shadow of that tradition that today also you find by the side of the dying person a purohit or a priest must remain. Whether they have the capacity of that initiate to make that dying person let go of his clinging, we are not certain. But the idea behind is something like this, that the possibility remains for the soul to linger in the Kamalokik region and not go to Devahan because there is an intense desire. But this is not true for each and every person who dies. Not each and every person dies with this sort of an intense desire to be fulfilled. And yet we find that not only the Pindam, Shraddha ceremony, elaborate other ceremonies for the dead are performed, mainly they are out of fear. One thing that will be told is that is what HPB writes. We have never heard anyone say that. But the Brahmin will tell you that if you don't perform this ceremony, you will be born as a chandala 1 crore times in a low caste. Or they will tell you that your dear departed one will not go in peace. He will not go to heaven. And this is what I think nowhere we have found it so movingly brought out as in Premchand Ji's novel, Godan. You know, where in Godan there is the poor farmer and his life's ambition is to buy a cow. And he works hard and finally gets a cow. And I'm not sure whether that cow died or not, but there is a sort of a famine where he loses his bullocks, he loses the cow, and they are actually plowing the field, husband and wife, placing themselves in place of the bullocks. Finally, of overexertion, this man dies. And what do the pandits say? Well, everything is fine, we will do all the last rites, but you have to do godan, the gifting of the cow to the Brahmin, else your husband will not find shanti or peace in the other world. Now this is very tragic. This is how you find the exploitation of the people who do not really understand that the after death states are effective states. They are going to depend upon the karma of your life. And if the good life is led, nothing can prevent you from having a good state after death. Giving a godan or not giving a godan is absolutely not connected. But this is where the superstition, this is where the blind faith, this is where the ignorance of the people comes into picture. And that's how you find lots of rituals and ceremonies continue to go on, mechanically being performed without really understanding whether they are necessary or not. And that's why when somebody also asked HPB that is it possible to do a ceremony so that the person will not be attracted to seance rooms, and she says yes, it can be done, provided you do it on that very night when the person has died and provided it is done. And again, the most important thing is it's done by a true occultist who is well versed in occult knowledge, and such are not to be found at every street corner, she says. This is the thing, how many, just like we say about astrologers, how many of them are intuitive enough to correctly interpret your horoscope? How many? And still more rare are the occultists who know the exact performance of these ceremonies. And that is why we find these two things. In notes on the Bhagavad Gita, Mr. Jat says, Shraddh and Pinda are now neglected because the inner constitution of man and the constitution of macrocosm are not understood in such a way as to make the ceremony of the slightest use. Dayanand Saraswati puts it little differently by giving a practical way out. He says, the original meaning of the word Shraddha is Shraddha, devotion. It is the duty of every son to serve his parents with all possible devotion while they are living. But the performance of Shraddha does not bear out the original idea at all. Shraddha really signifies to serve living parents with all devotion, not the dead. And it is therefore useless to offer pinda, rice balls, in honor of the dead, as it results in no good. Now, we find there are other ceremonies like housewarming ceremony. We specially mention it because this is beautifully explained in The Building of the Home by Sri B.P. Wadia, who says that as you enter the new house, well, you want to, as it were, make sure that it is purified. But think of it philosophically. Just as the body is to the soul, and through the body soul can have experience and do the learning, so also house is actually representing the home life. And the family members cannot do their learning and have their experience without this home life, and therefore they have to look upon this home life as a means for learning cooperation, tolerance, love. So while you perform your housewarming ceremony, if only at that time, if you make a sankalpa, if all the family members make a resolve that we will live in contentment, we will live in harmony, we will live in love, then the whole psycho-spiritual atmosphere of home will be so changed, so purified, that you will not require any feng shui, vastu, none of these, even housewarming ceremony. This is what is the idea which she gives. Ideas rule the world. Ideas held on the occasion of the housewarming and sustained through weeks and years will rule in the future, spreading light and peace within the home. And the home, like a lighthouse, will radiate then for the guiding of struggling neighbors. The home's neighborliness is the starting point of civic national life. Build a bright home and the city and the nation will become bright. Now, also there is the other ceremony which we know very well, is called the thread ceremony, Upanayanam. And in fact, Upanayanam, the other word is Upanita. The one who wears the thread is called Upanita. The one who is now going closer to God, because he wears what is known as Yajna Sutra. The thread is called Yajna Sutra. It's not ordinary thread. Yajna, as Gita, Shri Krishna says, I am Adi Yajna in this body. So Yajna means God. And sutra is the thread. It is that thread which ties or binds you to God. It's therefore having far higher, greater significance than what is made out to be. As a very interesting instance, in fact, happened in the life of Guru Nanak. We are told that Guru Nanak, when he was only a boy of 8 or 9 years, he was made to sit down for his thread ceremony. And everything was prepared, guests had come, Purohit had come, and he was sitting there, and Guru Nanak looked into the eyes of the Purohit and said, "Can you please tell me why this ceremony? What purpose is this thread going to serve?" And the Purohit said that, "Well, my dear boy, when you wear this thread, you will become eligible for performing all your social and religious ceremonies. The thread will purify you. The thread will purify you, and you will become aware of your religious responsibilities and so on." Immediately Guru Nanak said, "But sir, I know so many people of my caste who wear the thread, but they are not pure, and yet boldly they perform all kinds of religious ceremonies." And the Purohit was very angry, said, "Enough boy, no more arguments. It is written in the Shastras, it has been done by our forefathers, is that not reason enough for you to sit down and go through the ceremony?" And we are told that a almost holy presence descended upon Guru Nanak, and he uttered these memorable words where he said that from the cotton of compassion, spin the yarn of love, and on that thread of love, make the knots of unselfishness, truthfulness, tolerance. Concentrate on the thread every day, and you will find that you will not have to wash this thread again. It will never break, you will never lose. And the wearer of this thread is always going to be revered by other people. Now this was almost kind of coming from a higher plane. And it was Guru Nanak. And that is why first he could oppose at that tender age, and two, give the real significance of that ceremony to the Purohit himself. The Purohit was completely mellowed. But he said that, "Child, your parents have spent so much money, would you not go through it?" He said, "I am not going to enslave myself." Finally, when the mother told, "Won't you, my dear boy, do it for my sake?" And he said, "Okay, mother, if you say so, I will obey you." And he goes through the ceremony. Anyway, but the idea is that therefore there is far greater significance to the wearing of the thread. And one of the things, those who are interested can go through the whole article on the thread, the significance of the Brahminical thread. No, it is just called the Brahminical thread. And there, one of the things mentioned, a simple thing, that the three yarns of the thread represent the three chastisement, three kinds of controls: Vakya Sanyama, control of speech; Mano Sanyama, control of the mind; and Indriya Sanyama, or control of the senses. But more than that, you can see that it is, why they say that it is to be only worn by Brahmin? No, in fact, it's the thread which you wear is going to remind you that now you have to become a dvija, a twice born. You have to take a spiritual rebirth. And that is why, if I'm not mistaken, Arya Samaj, Dayanand Saraswati, does not restrict this thread ceremony to Brahmins only. It is given to people of all the castes, because everybody has to become a dvija. Everybody has to, as it were, undertake the journey to become really a spiritually regenerated man. And something similar you find even in Christianity, where there is baptism. Is baptism, does it mean that now after baptism only you have become Christian? Baptism, HPB says, is a rite of regeneration and purification. Something which is also followed by the Brahmins. Because there are bathing festivals held twice a year. I think the student has heard about, at a particular time in the year, they have a Ganga Snan. And in that Ganga Snan, people will dive into Ganga, thinking that their sins are washed off because you have dipped yourself into Ganga. But it is not true. But there is something which HPB mentions in Isis Unveiled, that in the ancient times there were temples. And with the temple there would be always a lake or a stream of water or reservoir of water. And in that, the priest of the temple will take all the idols And then with the chanting of the mantras and prayers, they would wash those idols and again put back in the temple. Why? Because it was felt that the deities have taken upon themselves the sins of the people. And this needs to be washed off. But the idea actually is that the very psychic atmosphere, the very magnetism of the temple is vitiated. Why? As HPP says, that there is psychic miasma in these places. With what kind of state of mind people go there? Are all of them deep devotees who just go to have darshan? Most of the people go with petitionary prayers. Give me that and I will give you this. Give me that and I will do that. And because of that bent of mind, the whole atmosphere is vitiated. So, to restore back the pure magnetism of the deities and the temple, this whole thing which she calls as this reservoir of water is actually called the baptismal font where the deities are washed. And it is actually a rite of purification which is akin to baptism. And at a still higher level, she talks about two kinds of baptism. There is baptism by water and there is baptism by fire. And baptism by water is something which was done, we know, by John the Baptist. John the Baptist came before Jesus and he was a forerunner who announced that there is somebody going to come, the Messiah that you are waiting for. I baptize you with water in the river Jordan, but he who is going to come will baptize you with fire. Now what does this mean? John the Baptist was also a learned man, but he was not initiated. So he would give out the teachings which are more of the, as it were, exoteric plane. He would give more of the dead letter interpretation, drawing attention to ceremonies and rituals. But when one wants to be getting wisdom or esoteric knowledge, it comes only when you are passed through the trials, temptations, the fires of temptation as it were. And then you are initiated into wisdom. That is why in the secret doctrine, she says that he, John, a non-initiated ascetic, can impart to his disciples no greater wisdom than the mysteries connected with a plane of matter, water being a symbol of that lower kind of mysteries. His gnosis, his wisdom, knowledge, was that of exoteric and ritualistic dogma, of dead letter orthodoxy. While the wisdom which Jesus, an initiate of the higher mysteries, would reveal to them was of a higher character, for it was the fire, wisdom of the true gnosis or the real spiritual enlightenment. So, this is the real meaning of baptism. And in that sense, Christian or non-Christian, all of us have to go through this ritual of baptism. Now there are also ceremonies which are pale shadows of what can be called as the ceremonies which were the mysteries of initiation. They were enacted at the time of mysteries of initiation. Take Mundan ceremony, the shaving off of the head. At one level, as the Mundaka Upanishad points out, it is really shaving off the non-essentials, your attachments to the world, fame, name, power, position, even self-identifying attachment with wife, children, etc. But at another level, the shaving off, the cutting off of the hair, you are able to, as it were, compare with what is given about the mystery of initiation. It is said that Surya was a candidate, neophyte. He is supposed to be the husband of Sanjana or spiritual consciousness. Sanjana is the daughter of Vishwakarman. He is a divine carpenter. And we are told that Sanjana complains to her father that there is a very great brightness of my husband, so do something about it. And Vishwakarman, being a divine carpenter, puts him on the lathe and cuts away 1/8 portion of the rays of the sun, creating around him a dark aureole, and then the sun looks as if he is wearing the crown of thorns. Compare it with Jesus, who is wearing a crown of thorns. And this, of course, HPP says, after that he is called Vikartana. And HPP points out that these are all the names given to the candidate or neophyte for initiation, and Vishwakarman himself represents the Hierophant initiator who makes the neophyte go through this process, and creating the dark aureole, darkness, is actually depicting how that disciple was made to sit in an underground crypt, cave, in the temple, in the pyramid, and he was to face dark side of his nature, all his weaknesses and vices. Without getting moved, as it were frightened, he has to overcome them and come out triumphant. And then there would be a ceremony when he is tied to a cross, just like Jesus was tied, and his body is exposed to the rising sun of the next day on the third day morning. Now, this is what that cutting, or as it were shaving off 1/8 portion of the race, is actually getting rid of the passions and desires of the neophyte. Now, also HPP compares it with the cutting 7 locks of hair. It is said that 7 locks of hair are cut. And she mentions how in the Tibet, the high lamas, they cut 1 lock of hair of a person who wants to enter religious life. And they say that the remaining 6 locks of the hair of the Upasaka will be cut when the Upasaka is ready. Now, one meaning given to cutting the 7 locks of hair is overcoming your 7 cardinal sins and developing the 7 virtues in the place, which is not something which happens easily, but only through much trial and suffering. Now, we find that certain rites, certain ceremonies and rituals, they have acquired prominence, they have gained, as it were, place, because the expounders said that this is according to the sacred text or scriptures. And one such rite which HPB mentions is the rite of Sati. We are well aware how Sati Pratha got so much prominence because it has the backing of Rig Veda. Those say that in the Rig Veda it is mentioned that if the widow will burn herself on the funeral pile of her husband, then she will get moksha. Now, how is it interpreted that she has to burn herself on the funeral pile of her husband? And HPB quotes Professor Wilson, who points out that in a certain shloka in the Rig Veda, the word Yonim Agre is changed and made into Yonim Agne, that is the womb of fire. So, in fact, she says, this is there in Isis and Veil, Volume 1, page 541, for those who would want to see. It's very interesting to read how exactly she has described what they do before she is taken, actually, on the funeral pile, etc. Now, it is pointed out that actually, if you see, according to the Vedic rituals mentioned in the Griha Sutras of the Vedas, she is first to accompany the body of her husband up to the funeral pile. After that, she is persuaded by chanting certain shlokas from Rig Veda and told, go back to the world of the living. Instead of that, the Brahmin says that no, if you die, you will get moksha. This again is stated that she is drugged or there is smoke. So first she dies already of asphyxiation, as it were. So actually the burning of the body is not painful to her. And HPB says the widow is not drugged. And it is not true that she dies of that kind of suffocation, because immediately as they light the funeral pile, there is a huge fire built. The amount of ghee and butter which is poured, and she does feel the pain. But the promise made is that she will get moksha. Now again, this is a pernicious rite, which people, because they think that there is a sanction of the scripture, they are willing to, as it were, give, again, credence to it. Now, all in all, we don't want to go on. All in all, we might say that, well, at a certain stage in time, these are reminders, some of these rituals and ceremonies. As we said about the sanskaras, they tell you that you are at a very crucial point in your life. And now, you are about to take a next step. And you are made aware of it as to what are your duties, etc. As like the marriage ceremony, if it is performed properly, it is full of meaning. It is a very, very solemn ceremony which prepares you for the commitment that you are about to make. for the householder's life and so on. But otherwise, a stage comes when these rituals and ceremonies must be put aside. And that is why what we find in all the religious scriptures, nowhere would they emphasize it so unduly as to be performed at the cost of your spiritual progress. Like for instance, take Buddhism. In Buddhism you find that yes, there are certain obstacles and fetters in the path in terms of your gross vices. You know, if you remain untruthful, dishonest, if you are slanderous, that's why we have the Panchashila. Something which right from the beginning, which is to be practiced by ordinary householder, it is to be practiced by a monk, it is to be practiced right up to the very last breath till you become a Nirvani. So this is the ethical virtues which you practice. But there are obstructions of a subtle kind, and these are termed as 10 spiritual fetters which come in the way towards Nirvana. And we are told that there are first 3 fetters which if you break, then and then only you come to a stage of becoming what is known as Shrotapati, which is a very high stage. Because once you become a Shrotapati, there are only 7 lives more for you to enter Nirvana. Now, what are the 3 fetters? Interestingly, you find the first one is called Sakaya Drishti or Sakaya Drishti, personality view. We won't get into it. It's a correct understanding. It's very necessary for you to have correct understanding as to whether anything survives after death or not. And if it survives, then what is it? Some views, they talk about Uchedavadin, Saswatvadin. Some say everything survives, some say nothing survives. There's the middle way which says, yes, there is a soul which survives, but that soul is changing. In fact, the whole idea is a continuous stream of consciousness, where one state of consciousness is dependent on the previous state of consciousness and so on. Now, the other is vichikitsa, that is the doubt. That it is quite possible for a person to not commit himself completely to a discipline. He goes on vacillating and doesn't commit himself. So this must be removed. And the third is what is important for us, is called Shila Vrata Paramarsha. Shila are ethical values, Vrata are rituals and ceremonies, and Paramarsha is grasping or attachment. There should not remain attachment for mere practicing of the virtues and mere performance of ceremonies and rituals. If there is attraction only for ceremonies and rituals, you continue to do that, then you are bogged down. You are not making progress. So Buddha says that the rituals and ceremonies, they are like a boat. The boat helps you to cross over the river, but once you have crossed over, you don't carry it on your head and walk. So at some point, you leave them behind. And that is why perhaps Aldous Huxley has said that if you want, you can transform your whole life in such a way that your whole life becomes one continuous rite. Every object is a reminder of God and every act becomes a sacrament. We have few minutes for asking questions.
It was said that after a person dies, if his wishes are unfulfilled, etc. Now, this was said in the case of a normal person.
Yeah.
But if there is an accidental death and if a mother dies leaving young children behind, she may have a desire for their welfare. And being an accident, the soul will not depart.
Yeah.
So, will her good wishes be effective?
Pardon?
Will her good wishes for her children have any good effect?
That we are always told, that good wishes of the dear departed ones are always effective. Not only those people who go to Devahan, that positively HPB says, even a mother who dies a natural death goes to Devahan, she says that love beyond grave is not imaginary. It is actual reality, love beyond grave. It's far more efficacious than even while she is living. And so, if such a mother, and in her Devahanic period also, she's all the time making subjective pictures of these children, wanting to see them in the best of condition, and her love is going to affect them. And especially, she says, in providential escape. And of course, even in endowing upon them a sort of a happiness. I think once we read in that time that it was called Sunday Review, or now it is called Times Life. But one girl, she has actually experienced this, that all the time that after her mother died and she was very attached to her, she kept on feeling a longing for this mother, that I wish she would come back, and she falls ill. And then, this is maybe what she imagined, but she got a lot of solace. Every time that she thought of her, there is this parrot which will come and sit near her. And somehow something will be conveyed without saying anything. As soon as the parent came and sat somewhere, she felt a sort of a bliss. And she felt that some way, somehow, through the parrot, this mother is conveying her good wishes or something to her. It was actually a whole story of her experience was given. And we would not brush it aside because this can happen. After all, as much as she was attached to the mother also must have been equally attached to this child that was left behind. So yes, her good wishes. And at times, she may even somehow convey it. Like once we were told from this platform, the whole thing about the airmen who would not die. Oh, there is that book. These are the people who died in plane crash. And they made it a point to linger somewhere very near to that home, because they were wanting to convey, I forget now exactly what is it, that message which they wanted to give. One, that their plane has crashed, and something else was wanting to be conveyed.
Yeah, money didn't reach because they were supposed to be insured, but it was not really done. And how to assist her financially is the way, like in the communication seances, communication, he explains to her, tells us what to do.
Yes.
Since she gets some money, he says that he will linger. Actually, after that, he stopped.
So you can see, there are examples and examples. But yes, it is possible for a person who is disembodied and who is having a great love to actually influence those who are left behind. And we are also told that during your Sushupti stage, without exception, each and every one of us rises to that high plane of Devahan, wherein you are communicating with your dear departed ones. But only you don't bring back the memory. So this possibility is also there.
So yeah. You said that after the people have that intense desire, is usually Kamalo. So my impression is maybe the assertion is continued to linger with the earthbound.
No, this is the case of intense desire where it is not possible for the soul to look. For the normal, this thing we are told almost immediately. Robert Crosby has written in Answers to Ocean of Theosophy that when there is a normal death, the separation of the soul from the lower principle happens almost immediately, averagely good life. But this is a truth that in case there is an intense, now not small desires, we all die with something or the other remaining in our mind. This is a case of an intense desire. So people sometimes ask that, oh, my husband died and I was actually pregnant that time. He must be wanting to see the child. So do you think that he must be remaining in the Kamalokic plane to see the child? No, not that kind. It's a question of very intense desire. So these are very rare cases. This also we are told, they are very rare cases when you find that the person remains attractive because there's something needs to be conveyed. But otherwise, no. It's very smoothly, it immediately falls into what is called as pre-Devahanic unconsciousness and gets into Devahan. Okay, our time is up.